You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Monday, October 8th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor of African American Studies at the University of Emory, Carol Anderson, on one person, no vote. Also on the program today, UN's IPCC issues a dire warning about climate change. We have 12 years to avoid catastrophe. Also on the program today, Brett Kavanaugh seated. Welcome to our new Lochner era. Meanwhile, Susan Collins rationalizes and Dems organize. And Brazil goes to a runoff between a fascist Bolsonaro to face Haddad in 3 weeks. Officer Jason Van Dyke convicted of second-degree murder in the killing of Laquan McDonald. And if you are a voter in Georgia, it's time to Google Salon Georgia Vote Purge to see if you are still registered. Got to do that very quickly. The Saudis reportedly kill a Washington Post columnist in their embassy in Istanbul because the new prince apparently... very forward-leaning.
But also a little touchy.
And a touchy. Meanwhile, a Chinese national detained in China forced to resign as president of Interpol. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. So, just a programming note. Kids are off from school today. I am going to leave the fun half to Michael. The interview with Carol Anderson recorded the other day before Brett Kavanaugh was seated. It is a particularly relevant interview to give everybody a sense of what we can anticipate, at least in the context of voting rights, but also to give you a historical perspective on where the court has been. And I think a good perspective on the way you should view history in the context of what we're seeing now with Brett Kavanaugh, because there have been in this country, obviously more than two sort of irreconcilable, at least to this point, perspectives on how our democracy should work. There have been other perspectives, and two major ones, but which is not to say that there aren't, you know, strongly a third or fourth, perhaps, one being more democratic and socialistic and the other being more authoritarian and fascistic. But two major forces that have run through our history, and they really, in many respects, there's an ebb and flow to where they, how strong they are in terms of identifying with their core brand proposition, as it were. But they have never gone away. And I think when you hear the conversation I had with Carol Anderson about what voting rights were like following the Civil War and following, really, Reconstruction, and you're going to see some parallels between 150 years ago and today, 130 years ago, I guess. And we're also going to enter an era now with Kavanaugh where we're going to see some things that are parallel from the first 25 years of the 20th century. Really, I guess a 40-year period, maybe from 1890 to maybe 50 years to 37, where, which is known as the Lochner era. We have talked about it in this on this program in various times. You can go back and listen to some of the Ian Millhiser conversations we've had. But it was a period when the Supreme Court regularly struck down economic regulations. In addition to upholding a lot of laws that disenfranchised voters. So basically, attack the rights of minorities and of poor people and enhance the rights of corporations. That is the sort of 101 version of what the Lochner era is, and we are about to enter a new Lochner era. The only upside that I can say to this, and it, you know, it's one of these things where it's, this is, I don't even want to say it's a silver lining around a cloud. Try and stay positive in these situations, but there is no calculation whatsoever where this isn't a massive net negative. Not to mention, Kavanaugh is a guy who I think is driven by the most hyper-partisan ideological find a result and then reverse engineer how you're going to argue to get there type of judge who's going in with a apparently quite a chip on his shoulder, not to mention a series of lies that he told to the committee. I mean, we just had the day after the vote, Chief Justice John Roberts received more than a dozen judicial misconduct complaints against Brett Kavanaugh, which a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals of the D.C. Circuit, because Merrick Garland, who is the Chief Justice of that court, I don't think that's what they call it, but the head judge of that court, recused himself for obvious reasons and handed over to Karen LeCraft Henderson. She dismissed some of the complaints against Kavanaugh as being frivolous. Others, she said, warranted serious consideration. They were based upon lies that he told during his hearings. So the guy is, best case scenario, a proven liar and an obvious liar. He obviously, and beyond that, you know, people make their own assessment. Here is Susan Collins. Now, look, here's the deal. People were saying, you know, why is Susan Collins getting so much grief about this vote as opposed to, say, the other 50 people, mostly men, who voted for Susan for Kavanaugh? Why not Joe Manchin to start with? Joe Manchin's a Democrat, at least nominally. He's a horrible Democrat from a red state. Joe Manchin, if Susan Collins does not vote for Brett Kavanaugh, Joe Manchin also does not vote for Brett Kavanaugh. That is the reality. There would have been no space for him to do it. He would have never been the deciding vote. It's still not helpful to have him vote for Brett Kavanaugh. It's indicative of, in many respects, what a corrupt guy he is. But that's the reality of the situation. There's a reason why they timed it all the way they did. There's a reason why Manchin waited for Collins to announce before he announced, because he had to make sure that she was actually going to do what she said she was going to do when they were meeting all together. And they had a sense of where they were all meeting. And by all of them, I mean Flake and Murkowski and Manchin. That's why Manchin announced after Collins. Because that is how his vote was contingent upon her vote. And the reason why Susan Collins gets more grief than the rest of the Republicans who voted for Kavanaugh is because she has branded herself in a specific way as a protector of women's rights, even though she's a Republican. She has branded herself as a so-called moderate. And then she went on the floor of the Senate and basically argued just about everything you could without bringing up Pizzagate. She is not a moderate. She may be slightly less strident when she speaks, but that's not the point of being a moderate in the Senate. She votes with Trump consistently, and then she goes on CNN and tries to sell this garbage.
Do you still think it is possible that he did it? You just don't have the proof to back that up?
I do not believe that Brett Kavanaugh was her assailant. So I do believe that she was assaulted. I don't know by whom, and I'm not certain when, but I do not believe that he was the assailant.
And so people watching you, hearing you say that, you understand that they'll think that you're saying you don't believe her, that she, I know you say that she believes that he was, but maybe she was wrong. But if she said that under oath and he said that under oath, you made a decision that he said is more valid than what she said.
In this country, we have a presumption.
All right, pause it for a second. Okay, she doesn't want to answer that question because the answer is obvious. But also note that she can't just decide that Blasey Ford was accurate in the fact that something happened to her. She doesn't know who did it, though. She doesn't believe her about who did it. But what she's also not saying is that I also don't believe that she must have made up or imagined Mark Judge being there. And she must have made up or imagined the existence of PJ and her close friend who was there at the party. Like, how nuts does Susan Collins have to believe that Blasey Ford is to say this? I mean, it's one thing to say, I'm going to have a completely unreasonable standard in which to reject this guy's application for the highest court in the land for a lifetime appointment. It's one thing to say that. I'm going to have a standard that's actually even higher than it would be in a civil court. This isn't court. But it goes criminal standard, civil standard, if you were going to sue for wrongful, for harm or something, I mean, there's a lawsuit that she could file. That standard is not beyond a reasonable doubt. And this isn't even a civil court proceeding. This isn't even a magistrate proceeding. This is a job interview. This is, we're going to sign off on you being hired for a lifetime appointment. But she makes up a standard and then pretends. This is how craven Susan Collins is. Continue.
Tree, we have a presumption of innocence. And as a matter of fairness, what I decided to use as a standard was the question of, is it more likely than not that Brett Kavanaugh assaulted Christine Ford? And there was no corroborating evidence that he did so. Each of the people...
Pause it. Well, but there was corroborating evidence, and everybody knows it. The fact that Blasey Ford had told her therapist 7 years ago, 6 years ago, that Kavanaugh had done it was corroborating evidence. The fact that Kavanaugh was a blackout drunk, and there was plenty of corroborating evidence to the idea that he was lying about that.
Like you said, the calendar with the names.
And somehow Blasey Ford got it down to almost the week that he was at a party with those same people. But she doesn't have the ability to know who assaulted her. I mean, this is absurd. It's absurd. It's embarrassing that she actually goes on television to try and push this stuff. But Susan Collins made a decision the other day. And Lindsey Graham made this decision a couple of weeks ago. McCain is gone. They have lost the cover of there being some other sort of like third way in the Republican Party. And their future lies in basically becoming Louie Gohmert. Just a little bit, you know, more polite. And now, I don't know how much they've raised now that will go to Susan Collins. It's over with $3.5 million now?
Yeah. They crashed the website within a half an hour of that.
But this is
indulgent,
this is,
disgusting speech of hers.
This is why Susan Collins deserves to be hit on this. It's not like she just made the vote and walked away. She is trying to sell it. She is her job, and she will get paid for it. She will get paid in support like we've never seen for Susan Collins from the Republican Party. Her job was to go out there and sell this to Republican women and muddy the waters and be the shill for the Republican Party. That's what her job is. You know, it's Orrin Hatch's job to dismiss the women with a wave and Chuck Grassley to say women are too busy to be on the Judiciary Committee. Did you not hear that?
Yeah.
We have it in the sound list? You should grab it. Play that later in the fun half. Chuck Grassley overheard saying the reason why there are no Republican women on the Judiciary Committee is it's too much work for them. So this is where we are. And I mean, the importance of this midterm election is obviously huge. And there is still a path to the Senate. It is, you know, very difficult, but we are a month away from the election. I use Heidi Heitkamp as just an example. The people who are motivated to vote for Heidi Heitkamp by this process are going to be just as motivated on November 8th as they were yesterday. The people who were activated in defense of Brett Kavanaugh and against the feminazis who would in some way endanger a potentially great man's opportunity to become a great man, they will not be as motivated. And so it's not just enough to vote, but go out and knock on some doors, tell your friends to vote, vote early. Taking the Senate is pretty crucial at this point. It's going to be much harder because a lot of the reason why the House is much easier at this point is because those districts where there are basically Republican women in the suburbs who are probably going to stay home, those tend to be the swing districts. And so those are the low-hanging fruit. But when you have red states, I think there are 10 states where you have Democratic senators running, or 10 Democratic senators running in red states. Much harder. So go out, organize. And the, you know, the next step is going to be to talk about reform of the Supreme Court. And I, you know, people are also talking about reform of the Senate. That's long overdue. You know, we should say the Senate originally, I hope people know, was not elected by the people in the state. It was elected by the state legislatures. They were chosen, essentially, right? I mean, there was an election, but I have a feeling it probably wasn't terribly contested for those first 100 years, more or less.
Do you think statehood would be a good first step as far as that goes?
For D.C. and Puerto Rico, without a doubt. It's absurd. It's absurd. But that is a step one in terms of reformation of the Senate, getting rid of the Electoral College, more democratic reforms. But I also think that pushing for court packing, I've stated this before, in my opinion, term limits on the court will be more durable, but push for court packing by all means. Because if that is a legitimate threat on the table, then a term limit is much more likely. And there should also be, to that end, get a commitment from your representatives to hold hearings on Brett Kavanaugh, whether he lied. And certainly Brett Kavanaugh should want that, to clear his name, to get out from under this cloud, to show all of those Clintonites who ginned up all of these claims against him that he didn't lie. Go through the Manny Miranda stuff when he received stolen information 12 years ago. Go through the questions of his drinking. Go through the documents that the Bush administration has. We're going to see some of those. They're going to be FOIA'd soon. All of this should be revisited. There is no other path. There is no other path, folks. Because, you know, we get a report today from the IPCC yesterday. There's only 12 years to keep warming to a maximum of 1.5 degrees Celsius, beyond which even half a degree will significantly worsen the risks of droughts, floods, extreme heat, poverty for hundreds of millions of people. You know, I've said this, I haven't talked about it for a while, but James Lovelock, the guy who found the hole in the ozone layer, was asked 10 years ago, 12 years ago, what he thinks we should do about climate change. And he says, essentially, oh, yeah, take a time machine. It's a conversation we should have had 30 years ago. He predicted by the end of this century, the world's population would be 80% less than it is now. Go from 6 billion to 1 billion. Europe will be sub-Saharan by 2080. He walked it back after a couple of months when people were like, you can't say that, because people are going to give up. But, you know, we have a problem in this country. I mean, obviously, we have a problem with China. They've got to dial back significantly, if this is the case. We've got to dial back significantly. But China's certainly not going to do it if we don't do it. And here is the problem. You can argue, and I know very few people who listen to this program do, although there are some. You can argue that Clinton and the Democrats wouldn't have done anything differently. But the fact of the matter is, no matter how much we agitate, Donald Trump and the Republican Party, who control all the levers of government right now, there is no way to get this country to do anything beyond maybe in California you can do stuff. There's no way to have a policy, a national policy, that is going to rise to the occasion. We're going to have to, there's subsidiary, this may be the most important story of the day, but the it is subsidiary in terms of the order in which it can be addressed. That's just the reality. A million people could march tomorrow in Washington about climate change. And Donald Trump will come out and say it's a hoax, and he will perceive it as helpful to his reelection. That is the problem. If Hillary Clinton was president, I don't care how neoliberal she is, a million people on the streets of Washington, D.C., all of whom voted for her, would make a difference. That's the reality of politics. Maybe on the day they both get elected, their intentions are equally the same. I don't believe that, but let's just stipulate that. But the reality of politics is, for us to now influence the policy of the American government in terms of climate change, we're going to have to make sure that we have more elected Democrats than Republicans. That's it. And then hope that Brett Kavanaugh does not start a jihad on that court with the other lunatics to basically invalidate every regulation that we could pass as a country to address climate change. So, not saying voting is the only thing that you should do. But for the next 4 weeks, it's the most important thing you should be thinking about. And not just your vote, other people's votes. So, do a phone bank, walking around your neighborhood even. And when you get to that last house on the street, ask them to go walk around and walk the other direction. Very, very important. All right, we're going to take a break. Do this interview with Carol Anderson on her book, One Person, No Vote. Mike will be doing the fun half. See you in a minute. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the professor of African American Studies at Emory University and author of the New York Times bestseller White Rage on her latest One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Carol Anderson, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Sam.
I have to start off by telling you that and my audience, that if they have not read White Rage, do everybody a favor and please do. It is really had an indelible mark on me and changed sort of my perspective on race in this country, on history on some level, and has influenced a lot of interviews I've done since then. I mean, I feel like we spoke just months ago, but I know it was a couple of years ago. And so I really appreciate that work. And then people should go and listen to the interview after they read your book. But
Thank you.
I want to talk about ultimately the relationship between what you wrote about in White Rage with what we're seeing in terms of this assault on the voting rights. I want to go through these voting rights. I think this audience is fairly well versed in these issues, but let's talk about the history of disenfranchisement that we've seen in this country and the way that it has, mutated, but also stayed the same.
Yeah. So, and that's you know, historians are always fascinated by issues of continuity and change. And disfranchisement, voter suppression, really sums that up. I guess a great way to start is the 1890 Mississippi Plan. And that was seen as a progressive measure. It was defined as a way to in corruption at the ballot box to make democracy pure. And that required the massive disfranchisement of black voters. But Mississippi couldn't say, we don't want black people to vote, because there was this thing called the 15th Amendment that said that the right to vote shall not be abridged on account of race. And so how do we say we don't want black people to vote and not get black people to vote? And what Mississippi did, and it was a plan then that other states modeled, was to develop a series of measures that looked at the societally imposed characteristics of a people, such as undereducation, so you're going to need a literacy test, such as poverty, so you're going to need a poll tax, and then created those kinds of devices that were so effective in staying on this side of the 15th Amendment. The U.S. Supreme Court approved literacy test, and the poll tax is not violating the 15th Amendment, while also getting to the point where those two things alone, as well as with Election Day terrorism, were powerful enough by the time that the U.S. was at war with the Nazis, 97% of African Americans in the South were not registered to vote.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, and we should say, right, I mean, that is, and, you know, forgive me for doing this, but what we're watching there is the response to Reconstruction and the response in many respects to the 15th Amendment. It is you're basically watching the white power structure attempt to roll back any gains that were made in terms of black voting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to do that in ways, and this is why, it's apocryphal, but they say Mark Twain's history may not repeat itself, but it show do rhyme. This way of saying this is about protecting democracy while it is about entrenching the white power structure by stripping African Americans of one of their key citizenship rights, which therefore leaves them vulnerable to stripping of array of other rights.
Okay, so and is this the first time we see this model? Because this is, I mean, like you say, it may not repeat itself, but it rhymes. This model of protecting democracy, so we will put restrictions on what it takes to vote. In one era, we may call it a poll tax. In another era, we may call it an ID that's issued from a DMV. Was this the first example of that? Was it the first time it was necessary? And are we talking about primarily southern states? How much was this an issue in northern states as well when we talk about, you know, Reconstruction and post-Reconstruction?
Okay, so this was primarily, the 15th Amendment made this a necessity. You know, prior to this time, prior to the Civil War, when the U.S. was founded, the vote was not universal. White male property became the kind of litmus test, the eligibility requirements. And the struggle since that time has been to open up the vote to make the democracy real, to make it vibrant. And the 15th Amendment was designed to do that. And then, boom, by 1890, this is when you see the rise of Jim Crow and the Mississippi Plan. The North did not have those kinds of restrictions. The North had other elements that it did. And so the North had the kinds of political machines where there was a patronage system, and so the North had a different kind of corruption going on. But this kind of systematic attack on the right to vote, that was a Southern phenomenon targeted at African Americans.
Okay, so when we see the essentially the
the blowback, right? I mean, it takes place. The 15th Amendment was passed, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was in 1870. And so
look at you.
it takes about 20 some odd years for the innovation, I guess, to take place on how they're going to roll back those protections. And then the Supreme Court blesses this form of voter suppression, which is, I mean, I could have been talking right. about the past 3 years, right? Or the past five
right.
years, I guess.
Right.
I mean, we have watched this. I mean, just draw some parallels. I mean, I think, you know, this must be occurring to everybody who's listening because we've covered this. But the parallels are stunning.
The parallels are absolutely stunning because part of what the Supreme Court decisions require is that you don't pay attention to the evidence. And I know having judges not pay attention to evidence, just it sounds like an oxymoron or something that doesn't happen, but it happens. So when the Supreme Court in the 1898 decision said that the poll tax and the literacy tests were actually valid because, you know, there were reasons for them to exist and it didn't deal with race, that what the poll tax did was the states were saying that democracy was expensive and it takes a lot of money to hold these elections, to have people voting and then having people there at the polls and having people count the ballots and all that takes money. And what this does then, the poll tax, it shows the kind of investment that people are willing to make in democracy. And if people aren't willing to make that investment, then they really shouldn't be voting. The literacy test dealt with the so-called need to have people who were knowledgeable about the laws of the state and the laws of the land. And so it required reading a passage of either the U.S. Constitution or the state constitution and then interpreting it to the liking of the registrar.
Which is somewhat subjective, I guess. Right. Well, and all right, continue.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Continue.
And so then, when we think about, for instance, the lie of voter fraud, because that's what we're dealing with now. Just the way we were dealing with the lie of this kind of mass corruption that required the massive disfranchisement of black voters. The lie of voter fraud that really came to the fore in the wake of the 2000 election. That was that Bush-Gore election. And we've spent a lot of time on Florida because Florida was just such a hot mess with the hanging chads and all of that. But it was in Missouri, St. Louis, Missouri, where the St. Louis Board of Elections had purged nearly 50,000 voters, primarily from Democratic districts, precincts, from the voter rolls, and didn't tell people that they had been purged from the voter rolls. So they show up to vote, and their names aren't listed on the sheet. Their names aren't listed on the rolls. And the poll workers can't get anybody downtown they can't even get through downtown to verify that these people are who they say they are. So they just send the people downtown. And hours are wasted downtown trying to get all of this fixed, trying to get all of this settled so that people can vote, which they had planned to do earlier in the day. So the Democratic Party then sued to keep the polls open for an additional 3 hours as compensation for the amount of time that people had to waste downtown when they shouldn't have had to do that anyway because their names shouldn't have been off the rolls. 45 minutes later, the Republicans came in and got a judge to overturn that decision and close the polls. And within 45 minutes, so the polls closed at 7:45. And there was so many people who never got to vote because they had been illegally purged and then illegally run around. Now, you could say, one of the things is you could say, wow, you know, there was a purge and that really worked for us, but that's not what the Republicans said. Instead, Senator Kit Bond started talking about, we've got to get these polls closed because this is a case of brazen, shocking voter fraud. You've got people who are repeatedly voting using addresses from vacant lots. We've got dogs on the rolls. We've got dead people on the rolls. They're trying to steal this election. And that language, that lie, what was an illegal purge by election officials, becomes the actual people themselves are committing voter fraud.
Right.
And yes, and an entire apparatus emerges around trying to rein in this rampant voter fraud, to where we get a Supreme Court decision coming out of Indiana, Marion County versus Crawford, where the Supreme Court acknowledged that Indiana passed a voter ID law in like 2005 or so, passed a voter ID law, and the ACLU and the NAACP sued. And the courts acknowledged, the U.S. Supreme Court acknowledged, there is no case of voter fraud in the history of Indiana. We can't find a case in the history of Indiana. Nobody's ever been charged in Indiana with this crime.
Well, it's also, however, we should be clear, too, that this is, voter fraud would be one of the silliest crimes to commit. I mean, honestly, like, because you would have to do this on a wide scale to implicate an election, at least a meaningful election. Like, I could see it happening in a small town. There's 50 people who live there, and you know, maybe you think you can get away with it there, and you could actually affect the outcome of the election. But it's an absurd crime to try and commit.
It is an absolutely absurd crime. And think about what it says. It says that you have somebody who is going in to the polls using somebody else's identification, somebody else's persona, and repeatedly voting over and over and over. And the absurdity of that, and the absurdity of that is then verified by numerous studies. One of the largest ones was by a professor out of California, Justin Levitt. And he found that between 2000 and 2014, there had been 1 billion votes cast in a series of elections. Out of those 1 billion votes, there had been only 31 cases of voter impersonation fraud out of 31 billion.
Wow.
But that's not what we hear from the Chris Kobachs of this world out of Kansas. We hear rampant voter fraud. From Donald Trump, we hear rampant voter fraud.
Well, and we heard this. We heard this. I mean, this started. I mean, I don't know if it started. Obviously, it didn't. It started apparently in 1890. But we also heard it during the Bush administration. The very controversial firing of all the U.S. attorneys was a function of Karl Rove saying, find me cases of voter fraud. And too many of them came back and said, I'm sorry, I can't. I mean, I simply cannot do it. And they were fired. And that is when a lot of this started. But wait, let me go back still a little bit, because I don't think people fully understand just how long black folk were disenfranchised by things like a poll tax, et cetera. And I want to just even go back to the 15th Amendment for a moment, because how much of a conscious decision was the 15th Amendment to leave open the door for these alternate forms of voter suppression? And I ask for two reasons. One, all of this could have easily been addressed on some level by saying everyone, every citizen has a constitutional right to vote that cannot be abridged for any reason, unless there's a compelling state interest or even like, it seems to me you could have written a one which wasn't so easy to maneuver around. And I also say that in the context of This is very similar to the dynamic, let's say, with Social Security, where it's, we're going to offer Social Security for everybody except for these two or three sectors, like domestic help and farm help, mm-hmm. which just happen to have the highest concentration of African-American folk and maybe Latino folk and women. And that's just a coincidence. Of course, it was not a coincidence. I mean, how much of the 15th Amendment was that dynamic in play?
I think, let me back up to the 1867, yeah, because we're in Reconstruction, the 1867 Reconstruction Act, which is, you know, 2 years after the war. And that act said that basically black men had the right to vote because women, period, did not have the right to vote. But it was saying that black men had the right to vote. And what the radical Republicans, and I know that sounds like such an odd term now, but that was the name of the powerful group within Congress. What the radical Republicans were afraid of is that as political winds shifted, that law would be easily overturned, would just be easily scrapped. And so they thought, let's do a constitutional amendment. Because one of the things that they were concerned about, and rightfully so, was that without the right to vote, the unrepentant white folks of the Confederacy would continue to try to reinscribe slavery by another name. They would do everything in their power to subjugate black folks. And as long as African Americans did not have the right to vote, then these politicians would not have to be responsive to the needs of that very large constituency. Mm. And so by creating the 15th Amendment, and so you've got this constitutional amendment that says that the right to vote shall not be abridged on account of race or prior conditions of servitude, that was supposed to handle it. It was supposed to handle it, but the ways of the U.S. Supreme Court that just did violence to the 14th and 15th Amendment. The 14th Amendment is the one about birthright citizenship and due process, equal protection under the law, and the 15th Amendment. The Supreme Court read those key Reconstruction amendments as something that they weren't, so that the 14th Amendment really isn't about individuals' rights, but it's about corporate rights. Corporations have the right. Right. And that the 15th Amendment really wasn't about the right to vote. So watching these key amendments that were put in place to provide the protection, the kind of legal protection so that African Americans could enjoy their citizenship rights, be gutted by the highest court in the land and have the highest court in the land basically in league with unreconstructed rebels was what took us, frankly, with the kind of array that the Mississippi Plan entailed. So like the grandfather clause was in there. The grandfather clause said basically if your grandfather could not vote prior to the 1867 election, you can't vote. Well, 1867, and they didn't say election prior to 1867. Well, that was the Reconstruction Act of 1867. So whose grandfather couldn't vote before 1867? Right.
I mean, it's such a perfect, also exemplar of what is highly problematic with the Supreme Court, what has been problematic mm-hmm. with the Supreme Court, what yes. will be yes. problematic with the Supreme Court. And then we'll jump up to modern day in the way mm-hmm. that they have been dealing with any number of cases, whether it's the Texas redistricting, which stands out, whether it's Shelby. I mean, a bunch of these cases stand out as perfect that you could literally pick them up and drop them back into the reasoning of the poll tax. But, you know, the plain reading of the 15th Amendment is on account of race, right? Not by the use of race, but on account of race, which means that
on account of race,
you don't have to put the words black people can't vote for it to be on account of race. You simply have to actually make a calculation. What is the real aim by this? And you can measure that by who it impacts in a disparate manner.
Exactly. And it took the Supreme Court. So that came, the grandfather clause came into being in 1890. It was not found unconstitutional until 1915.
And
so we had a generation.
And then we still had poll taxes, if I'm not mistaken, well into the middle of the 20th century.
Right. The poll tax was finally abolished in both federal and state elections by 1966, I believe.
Wow. So, I didn't realize it was that late. Wow.
Yeah, there's actually a constitutional amendment banning the poll tax. The literacy test was basically abolished with the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So we are in living memory of so many people. So, you know, we see the kind of cinematic images coming off of Selma and the Edmund Pettus Bridge in this battle to vote. And it is because of the stranglehold of disfranchisement had some counties in the South that had sizable minority populations having less than 1% of their black population registered to vote. Some, it was a percentage point. It was in some, like Lowndes County, Alabama, had zero African Americans registered to vote by the early 1960s. So this disfranchisement has been rolling through for three generations, and it has been lethal in terms of the kinds of policies that emerge. So, you know, you talked about Social Security. You can only have that kind of conversation if you have politicians from the South who are elected by less than, say, 10 to 15% of their adult population. Because there were times, like by the time we get to 1942 in the midterm election, where only 7% of age-eligible voters actually voted in the Deep South, 7% in a midterm election. When we get to the 1944 presidential election, it was 14%. Whereas the national average was 62%. So when you only have to be responsive to a very narrowed band of your voting population.
Why was that band so narrow? I mean, in part because 95 some odd percent of black people can't vote. What constituted the other? Just abject poverty, or what was keeping the other people?
So poverty also played a key role, as did, and they were very clear when they were drafting the Mississippi Plan of 1890 that they didn't want a lot of whites to vote either.
Right.
There's one Mississippi politician said, yeah, and this is going to get rid of the vicious white too. And it did. You saw the overall voter turnout rate begin to just plummet because the system is so rigged. And they had these little cutouts for some whites to be able to get through. But overall, it felt like the system was rigged because that's what rigged systems do. They depress voter turnout. That's what stringent registration rules do. They depress voter turnout. And making it clear, there's a framing to the right to vote that treats the right to vote not as a right, but as a privilege.
Right.
A privilege that has to be earned by jumping through a whole series of hurdles and barreling through a number of obstacles. And so overall, what was going on in the Deep South is that you did not have a functioning democracy. You had a small ruling oligarchy that then, because of their seniority, because they kept getting reelected, because heck, you know, they really didn't have.
They knew everybody who was voting for them practically at that
right,
point.
Right. You know, is that they then held the seniority positions of the various chairs in the U.S. Congress. So, you know, they're on top of the Foreign Relations Committee. They're on top of the Judiciary Committee. And in those key spots, they're able to shape federal legislation. So watching Jim Crow being inserted into the Social Security Act during the height of the Great Depression is one example. This kind of systematic denial of the right to vote to American citizens in one region, it has enormous impact nationwide.
And so we follow the history and we see the Voting Rights Act comes in. We see later amendments that close the door on these sort of, you know, I guess, long-lived but fairly blunt instruments to suppress the vote. And it feels like then, you know, if we track that to the late 60s, we have really 30-some-odd years of a fairly consistent regime of protecting the rights to vote. We have the Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which has preclearance for some 12-odd states in counties in 14 states, including New York had two counties, if I'm not mistaken, that were subject to preclearance, which meant that they could not change their voting rules without the DOJ signing off because they had a history of being racially, of discriminating based on race in some fashion. And then, of course, there was also other provisions of the Voting Rights Act, which could push states into that category of needing preclearance and other things that would allow the DOJ to go in and prove. And then we have these, you've described now when the first, stringent voter ID laws creep up in the early aughts. It's as if like when the Dixiecrats moved to the Republican Party, they said, okay, now we've got to change our strategy. It's no longer we are oligarchs that exclude all black people, essentially, and poor white people. We've got to now open up a couple of doors for white folk to come in, rebuild our base, and then we can go back to imposing stringent restrictions that hopefully will catch the right type of people we want to catch.
You know, and what you're talking about is the Southern strategy that Lee Atwater defined so brilliantly. And Lee Atwater was Ronald Reagan's strategist. And what Lee Atwater said was, you know, in 1954, you could say the N-word, and it wouldn't hurt you. But by 1968, which is, you know, we've gone through the civil rights movement. By 1968, you can't say it. It hurts you. It backfires. And so the response then isn't, so, you know, we need to really move on to a non-racial policy, a non-racist policy. Instead, what Lee Atwater says, and so then, so what you start doing is you start talking about economic things, like cutting taxes or forced busing or states' rights. And the whole point of this, he said, is that blacks get hurt worse than whites.
You may take some whites, you may hurt some whites as well, but the overall impetus is going to be, and certainly the perception is, right? Like the idea is that
exactly.
We think about welfare, we are trained to think that, oh, these are just handouts to black people.
Right. And that is, you know, again, a key element of the Southern strategy. When you think about the way that Reagan talked about the welfare queen in Chicago. He didn't say the welfare queen in Paducah, Kentucky.
Right.
He set the welfare queen in Chicago. That is what, you know, we call a dog whistle. And so in that policy of now, how do we craft, because a key element in this, and as you talked about it, the wooing in of the Southern Democrats into the Republican Party began to push that party further and further ideologically and policy-wise to the right. So you start seeing virulent anti-immigrant policies coming up. You start seeing very stringent anti-civil rights policies emerging. Now, the problem is, besides those policies just being odious, is that the demographics in America are changing. America is becoming significantly more diverse. And as America becomes more demographically diverse, those Republican policies become more repugnant to a larger and larger share of the American electorate. So if you're a political party, you're looking up here and you're going, okay, so we've got two options. And the Republicans did talk about this. We've got a couple of options. We can either begin to reform and open up our party to begin to embrace. I mean, it's going to be hard for us to embrace black people, but how about embracing immigrants? How about doing that? And the response was no, absolutely, positively not, no. And so then the response, the next one was door number two. Okay, so then how do we begin to shut down the demographics that we know overwhelmingly will not vote for us? And I think of Paul Weyrich, who was the head of ALEC and one of the founders of the Heritage Foundation. And he said in a speech, he said, I don't want everybody to vote. Because, frankly, our leverage goes up as the voting population goes down. And that becomes the blueprint. How do we keep more and more voters away from the polls? How do we discourage voters? And so you start seeing elements of that where they begin to learn that demographics are not destiny. And so we begin to see elements of that. And Obama's election really sent this policy into overdrive. Because what he did was he did not get the majority of white voters. No Democratic candidate since 1964 running for president has received the majority of white voters. But he got a sizable number. But his ground game brought 15 million new Americans to the polls. People had never voted before. And they were overwhelmingly black, Latino, Asian, poor, and young. That coalition was instrumental in Obama's victory in both 2008 and 2012. When you look at these voter suppression laws, they are targeted right at that coalition.
We have voter ID that affects African-American folk and Latino folk. And in some states, what ID they'll accept will impact a lot of college students who may be in certain areas. I want to just touch on what cases, and I think people are familiar with the 2013, was it, when the Voting Rights Act was really, in many respects, gutted. And with the excuse, I think it was Scalia had said, well, the Senate reauthorized this, but they only did it because they were afraid of doing something that would be perceived as being racist. And they didn't mean to do it or something to that effect. And I think Roberts called it, or maybe it was Alito, called it some type of a giveaway. Essentially, to black folk, but what cases, one or two cases, sticks out for you as the most reminiscent of that Supreme Court that found poll taxes fine, that found literacy tests okay? Is there any case as of recently that sticks out for you?
That's a great question. I've got to say that when I talked about that Marion County v. Crawford case coming out of Indiana, that sticks out because there Justice John Paul Stevens has to admit that not only has there been no case of voter impersonation fraud in the history of Indiana, but that the cases that were talked about could not be addressed, would not have been stopped by voter ID. So I'm thinking, okay, so we're done here, right? There's no case of voter ID. There is no state interest in this thing, except in blocking poor people and black people. And the NAACP and ACLU had incredible data about the impact of this law on those voters. And the court just overlooked it and basically said they didn't believe it. It really wasn't, that evidence really wasn't evidence for all intents and purposes. But they believed the voter fraud lie, although the state could produce no evidence of voter fraud. That is what provided the constitutional basis for voter ID laws.
It really is stunning, and I think I would also tell people as we wrap up to look at the case in Texas, which is stunning in my estimation. This was a case where they gerrymandered. A court found that they had done it with racist intent, and they basically stretched it out. They needed an emergency. They needed emergency map. For another election, the legislature adopted largely the map that was considered racist, but because they just adopted one that had been drawn earlier, they couldn't have had any racist intent. It was just expediency, and therefore they were deemed no longer racist. I mean, that to me was stunning. What has to happen? I mean, because we are days away, maybe months, but who knows, away from having a court that is going to be very much like that court in 1890s, ones that found the poll taxes. Okay. I mean, what do we do?
Okay. And so there's several things that we do. One is that we register to vote. It is absolutely imperative that we are there voting. And whom we're voting in, we're paying attention to that because we're voting in folks who believe in democracy, who believe that American citizens have the right to vote and that it's a right, it is not a privilege. The second thing that we do is that we insist on... when we have these gerrymandered districts, for instance, and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania have really, I'm trying to do the scholarly thing, but ugh was the only word that came out, because Pennsylvania drew its map in such a way that the Republicans received 49% of the vote, but 72% of the congressional seats. And when that thing rebounds and eddies through, what has happened is that we have 16 to 26 additional unwarranted seats for Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives. And that's where we begin to see, and with these gerrymandered districts that protect these representatives from the will of the voters. We began to see this massive disjuncture between the will of the people who want an Affordable Care Act and access to quality health insurance, who want DACA, who want legislation dealing with semi-automatic weapons, who want the Children's Health Insurance Program, who don't want a tax bill that transfers over $1 trillion to the uber wealthy. That disjuncture is the result of gerrymandering. So we need to insist, and there are ballot initiatives like in Michigan, to have nonpartisan redistricting commissions come to the fore. We also need to elect a Congress that believes in the Voting Rights Act so that we can get a reestablished Voting Rights Act put in place. Now, it's going to face a bucket load of judicial challenges. We know that. And so it's going to have to be written tightly, smartly, and we're going to have to continue to fight because this latest wave has put American democracy in peril. It really has. And that's not hyperbole. That is, when you look at the ways that the guardrails have come off this system, when you look at what we thought were laws that only turned out to be norms, that somebody who is conscienceless does not care about norms, can just blow right through them. Well, you can see that the checks and balances aren't checking and they aren't balancing, but that they're in cahoots to recreate the kind of oligarchy that was happening in the Deep South. That's why we must vote. That's why we must put people in power who are very pro-democracy, and why we must also support the civil organizations such as the ACLU, NAACP, all of these grassroots organizations who are fighting voter suppression. We need to support them as well because they've been doing the heavy lifting when states have refused.
Carol Anderson, the book is One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. We will put a link over at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Sam.
We are back. The indispensable Carol Anderson, White Rage, is a must-read for understanding our time. One Person, No Vote, covering really important ground as well, obviously. We're a month away from elections. What happened in Brazil yesterday, I think, is another indicator of the importance of, yes, in conjunction with many other steps, but indeed voting, and voting in a non-perfectionistic or silly manner to avoid truly catastrophic outcomes, especially when those outcomes are very easily predictable, like extremely easy, like people of very, very, like, it takes no extra insight to predict those outcomes.
In terms of things that take a couple hours, there's little politically impactful as voting.
There is, and in some cases, less. There are a few things that might, as an example, you might spend literally months or years tweeting nonsense or, you know, watching dumb videos. And you might, I voted a couple weeks ago for Jumaane Williams and Cynthia Nixon and Zephyr Teachout. And also a guy whose name I'm forgetting, but a good candidate who knocked out an IDC Democrat in our same district, Matt. And it took me literally, and I'm including the walk, a little bit of a walk to the polling place, 25 minutes. And now, it was very emotionally intense for me because Cynthia Nixon does not represent every single intricacy of all of my philosophical inclinations and policy portfolio. So I had a very emotional day dealing with that act. But then I did it and it was extremely easy. It also just every time you know, Carol Anderson and, you know, sort of not only historical perspective on voter discrimination, but the overt strategy of white supremacy through ICE policies, through rolling back voting rights. It's just something that can't be toyed with. And then conversely, you know, people on the right get into power and they immediately go about assembling strategies to restrict power. And then we don't govern in a way that expands and entrenches power, which actually for the left means giving power to much more people.
The fun thing about us changing the electorate in a way that helps our side is expanding the vote and representation to more people.
Right. our version of playing, of being ruthless, which is good. I won't say playing dirty, but being ruthless means people in Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. aren't disenfranchised anymore. Like, that's the kind of ruthless, or
that's
that,
left fascism.
Left, a left authoritarianism is people in Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico are represented nationally and not taxed without representation. Left authoritarianism, or left fascism, or whatever, it means that we inject democratic accountability on the Supreme Court by introducing term limits and expanding seats. And even though the votes are not anywhere near there, having serious investigations for issues like conflicts of interest and potential past criminal behavior for at least two of these justices, Brett Kavanaugh, Clarence Thomas. So, buy the book, go out, get involved in these elections wherever you are and at every single level.
Oh, Zellner Myrie.
Zellner Myrie?
That was the guy who beat Jesse Hamilton.
Am I wrong or was it flipped?
Was it Zellner?
I know Jesse Hamilton was the bad guy, but was it Zellner Myrie or Myrie Zellner?
No, it was Zellner Myrie.
Okay.
Yep.
I'm just a dyslexic moment for me. I apologize. Yes, Jesse Hamilton was the IDC far-right Democrat Republican. I mean, that's a good example. A left, I believe the district we're in Brooklyn has the highest concentration of DSA members. And this guy, Jesse Hamilton, had represented it for several terms, had been part of the IDC corrupt agreement, propping up the Republican majority, stalling left legislation, and, you know, had just machine networks in low turnout primaries. And that's it. Until, you know, a young, actual left progressive candidate went at him. And well, gave a choice, and we had to go out and vote for that choice and make that actually happen. And that will have a real tangible difference in terms of how things are done in this state.
There's a strong anti-incumbency factor out there that can be taken advantage of by socialists or non-socialists alike. So you want to get in there with the socialism.
Indeed. Okay, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. It's how this show happens. There's a link to it in the show notes if you're not a member yet. Pennies a day for a 5-day-a-week left, progressive, ecumenical left, broad perspective on news, culture, analysis, in-depth interviews, and, of course, a fun half. Become a patron of the Michael Brooks Show. It's a weekly deep dive into politics, sports, culture, trends, with a very global focus. And of course, we have a lot of fun. We have a great, entertaining post game. We have in-depth, illicit histories on everything from Africa, Canada, Brazil, political theorists. There's a lot going on there, plus Woke Bros, which I do at WAZ. We had a great time. We did a sold-out show. I was a special guest for Count the Dings at the Bell House in Williamsburg on Friday. That was a lot of fun. Of course, get Jamie's not here with us today, but Antifada is her podcast that she does with Sean. And also, who's the third gentleman? Something, Andy BK? Is that right?
Yes, that's right, I think.
They are coming at you as well. Check out the Antifada, patreon.com/theantifada. Matt.
Literary Hangover, we had a new episode. This one was a non-fiction version. We did Corey Robbins' The Reactionary Mind.
Very nice.
We talked about MR members might like to hear our discussion of the zero-sum debate. Corey Robbins talks about that. So, and then broadly, we talk about Robbins' thesis that what we're going through now is basically a late-stage counter-revolution against the New Deal and the sort of liberation movements that followed that.
Yep.
And the Republicans, where they're impotent, you know, for instance, they were unable to slash certain Obamacare things. They're unable to, you know, take care of all the entitlements the way Paul Ryan might do. And Corey Robbins' suggestion is that's because they've already kind of won a lot of the victories that they've been fighting over the last 40 years. So, like, to take one example, schools are still as segregated or more segregated as they were than Reagan was in office, for instance. Right.
Right.
So, and it's an interesting discussion. I think Corey Robin, I think we're going to have him on soon, aren't we? We got Robin coming up. I don't know. Anyway,
smart.
We've had him on a couple of times at least.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the way he thinks about these things, it's actually one of the oddly, it's not super optimistic, but it's an important, I think, historical view of, you know, the ongoing authoritarian menace globally.
Indeed. Corey Robin, essential read. We're going to go to the fun half. We'll see you there.
You right. are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Who sent us this?